everyone, my name is Malavika Prasad. I'm the host of the Your Favorite Book podcast, a show all about answering that big question, what's your favorite book and why? I have no real credentials. I just really like books and I love talking to writers and readers alike about the books that have shaped who they are. And it's a new year, so I'm calling it a new season, season four, even though I guess in the podcasting world, seasons don't actually mean all that much. Before I introduce my guest, I just want to have a few housekeeping details. So first of all, if you missed some of the announcements in the last episode, which was my favorite books of 2021, I wanted to announce a couple things. First thing is we will be going back to weekly episodes. So every Thursday, you can expect some content. Gonna try to keep this up for the time being. We'll see how long it lasts. And then my second piece of news is that starting at the end of this month, we will be having our monthly short story book club. So basically what that means, if you've ever wanted a low stress book club, this is your place to start, because really all we're doing is we're reading one short story every month, and I announce it at the beginning of the month, and then at the end of the month, you can tune into an episode all about a close reading of that short story with a very special guest. This month, in January, we're going to be reading The Waltz by Dorothy Parker. So if you are new to Dorothy Parker, if you are an old favorite, you definitely want to check into this episode. I am super excited to discuss it, and I'll be announcing who our guest is pretty soon. But to this episode proper, my guest is the acclaimed author Jamie Attenberg. Jamie has written novels like All This Could Be Yours and The Middlesteins, but what we're talking about today is her memoir, I Came All This Way to Meet You, Writing Myself Home. Jamie is a wealth of information, and I'm so grateful she found a little time to speak with me during her busy pub week. And then we also talk about a favorite book of hers, which is a first for this show, a collection of short stories, The Collected Stories of Grace Paley. So we dig into those and really talk about a true master of the short story form. And so here we go. Happy listening. Hey, Jamie, welcome to the show, and thank you for taking this time in what I imagine is a very, very busy pub week for you.
I'm so happy to be here. We were talking before you started recording that my brain is a little bit mushy, but I'm really excited to talk about books.
And this is the thing that occurred to me. I mean, you are not new to the book publishing and the book release business. Does it ever get any easier, or is it still the same?
Well, you know, it's radically different right now. I was reflecting yesterday, because yesterday was my pub day, and it was, you know, one day of running around, and it used to be like you ran around for weeks on end, and now it's just kind of, you know, I'll be just doing virtual events for the rest of this time. So, I mean, in terms of getting your work reviewed, you know, like that part about it is still has like, you know, you go through all these different kinds of emotions, but I don't know. I don't know what it's going to be like to put a book out in the world, you know, how it sort of rolls out, because it's different. But I definitely think, like, wow, the way my career used to be for the last 15 years, it's going to be different.
Right. Because, like, even though you think with the virtual events, okay, maybe a little less travel than you're used to, at the same time, that's a different kind of exhaustion. As anyone who's spent time on Zoom meetings or anything like that, you know, it's exhausting nonetheless.
It really is. So the piece of advice that was given to me last night by my friend Emily Gold, when she had a book that came out, I think maybe like, I want to say like April 2020, something like that. And she said that the best thing you can do is make sure that you actually have some sort of social event or some sort of social interaction after you do the Zoom. So you don't just like feel like you're there, you've shown up, and then you close the window, and then there's like kind of feelings and you don't know what to do with them, or it feels emotional or something like that. And it feels like you're not really doing like a real event, or you're in a real moment. So She was like, see if you can meet somebody for a drink afterward, or see if, you know, you can take a walk or something like that, so that there's some sort of real world interaction that's going on. So, I mean, I'm going to give it a shot. I have six coming up. So,
oh my gosh.
Yeah. Six in like, I think 2 weeks or something like that.
That's insane. And so I reiterate, thank you for joining me on this little show. I appreciate that very much. And so I'm about to ask you a question you've probably answered 1,000 times, but can you tell us a little bit about your latest book?
Sure. It's my first memoir. I've written 7 books of fiction, and this is my first time in the memoir game. And it's called I Came All This Way to Meet You, Writing Myself Home. And it's about, you know, it sort of spans like probably mostly like a 15-year period, although I think it kind of like encompasses my entire life. And it's really about me looking at everything that has gone into making my life and my career as a writer, and also as a woman, and also as an American and a human being. But really the focus on it is everything that sort of, you know, every struggle that I've had and every success that I've had and the ups and downs and joys and challenges of being a writer.
That's a really great way of summing this up, because I've had a couple people who write nonfiction and memoirs of kind, and I ask, you know, can you encapsulate this? And your memoir especially, you know, it's not limited to a specific period of time in your life. You span quite a bit of time. You span quite a different set of different topics. And so the commonality here is your life, and especially how writing sort of informs how you reflect on your life. And one of the things that really struck me about your book, which I really, really loved, by the way, throwing that out there.
Thank you.
But one of the things that struck me is there is a tremendous amount of detail in this book, detail in how you recount certain events, you know, people, places, specific events, things like that. And maybe it's me having a terrible memory. I can barely remember what I ate for breakfast yesterday, but tell me a little bit about how detail comes into nonfiction. Is that part of you supplementing as a fiction writer and filling in where necessary? Or do you really just remember everything quite that well?
I mean, I have a really garbage memory too. And as you read in the book, I used to do a lot of drugs. So there's definitely like whole swaths of time where I was like, I'm not even going to bother with it. And in fact, actually, it was like easier to sort of pinpoint the last 15 years because I had photographic evidence, mm-hmm. right? So like, I think that part of it is that I had these cell phones, you know, cell phone, I mean, whatever, 2009 or 10 is when I started, when I had Facebook, but even earlier than that, I was probably posting things on Flickr, and I had, you know, I didn't really have a cell phone camera, but I had a digital camera, but like having those photos is helpful to me. There was previously published material that I used or reused, I should say, chopped up and put into the book when I needed to do it. I've had, I didn't look through too many journals, I would say. I really didn't want to like go back to my college years. I've kept journals for years, but whenever I like was going up to the attic to look at them, I just was like, well, let me see if I need them yet, you know, that kind of thing. But there's some stuff that does stick with you, and I don't think that I really supplemented it. You know, I think I mean, there's definitely times where I change details to protect people, and there's some compressed characters and things like that. But in terms of like the layering, the texture, the details, that's just stuff that I, you know, found here and there, knew or had some sort of physical evidence of it.
Okay, that makes me feel a lot better, because I was wondering, how on earth is she remembering things that people are wearing and exact routes that she was going? And I'm like, oh, duh, photographs. So that really helps.
Yeah.
But something that came to mind, you know, as you were talking about that and choosing what to include, what not to include, and how to sort of craft this is, tell me about framing a memoir. How did you come up with the idea, A, writing a memoir in the first place? How do you get to that point? And B, framing it in the way that you have, sort of around writing, around this idea of home and travel and sort of lessons learned along the way. Is that something that came immediately to you, or was the framing device something that came later?
So I wrote the memoir. I mean, there's a couple of reasons why I wrote the memoir, but, you know, one of the reasons that sticks out in my head is that there's a chapter in the book that's called A Trip to the End of the World, which originally was the title of the book. Actually, there's been a couple titles along the way, and that was one of them. And I worked on that for a long time. It was, you know, it was a tough nut to crack. Probably like years I worked on that. And I kept rewriting it. And finally, I found like the right context for it, the right framework for it. And then when I was finished with it, I just thought, no one's ever going to actually publish this. Like, it doesn't fit into any sort of neat box, like a neat, it's not a New Yorker piece. It's not a, you know, Vogue magazine piece. It's not, I don't know. It just was, it's long, it's unruly. It's not, it's a sort of unconventional and both unconventional and conventional subject matter. And it just wasn't going to fit anywhere, but it was a really important story to me. And so I think part of it was that I wanted that chapter to be published, and I wrote an entire book around it. So, and it is kind of a really important part to the book. It's, you know, everything sort of leads into that. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of my origin story as well. Mm-hmm. So I guess what I did was I wrote a ton of stuff. I wrote about 92,000 words. And then with my editor, we started chopping it. And then I kind of kept reframing it and just trying to figure out, there's a lot of different through lines. There's a lot of different structural elements throughout that sort of keep, you know, it operates in some ways much like my novels do. Mm-hmm. So I started to treat, I at some point I was like, I need to treat this in a novelistic fashion. Like, I didn't want to get, not use the skills that I've spent the last 15 years developing.
Right.
So to me, it's like, my approach is not that it's a memoir, but that it's a book. And it's a book of stories, and that sort of like all like feed into the, like the giant story, which is the story of me.
Yeah.
And so I just was like, what's the best and most interesting way to kind of display this information? So I just chopped it up the same way that I chop a novel up. Like, once the story becomes clear to me, it's just really about how do we present it in a really interesting way. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it doesn't operate necessarily in a linear fashion, or it sometimes kinds of loops around and you see like the same sort of moment in time, but from a different angle. And that's really true to my fiction writing. And it's, you know, I wanted it to feel kind of playful. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but it happens in the order that it needs to happen in, I would say, even though it's not a linear path necessarily.
I think that makes a lot of sense because, I mean, you can write a memoir in a lot of different ways. You can go that straightforward, and then I was born, and then I did this and that. But honestly, chopping it up in a certain way really makes sense with the content you're presenting, because like you said, this isn't a straightforward story of your life. There are parts you're highlighting, parts you didn't include. You know, this is a set of stories that feed into your life as a narrative, and that makes a lot of sense. And to sort of speak to that specifically, so you and I actually have something in common. I'm also from the northwest suburbs of Chicago. My family lives in Long Grove, and you mention it by name. That's, and I so thought funny. That was really funny.
I spent a lot of time there growing up.
And that really shone through to me. You, even though a lot of this book doesn't take place in the suburbs, when you do write about the suburbs, it just came through so impeccably well. Do you mind if I like read a sentence?
No, go ahead.
No, so you have just a little fragment here of, I love a place with two pizza parlors and one Chinese restaurant and one burger place and one steak place and one small department store. And it goes on, and then it starts to change. It starts to change into a location. It starts to change to housing developments. And then it sort of feeds into, you like the myth of the suburbs. You like the idea of the suburbs, even though you know what it is built upon. And I just thought, even though the suburbs specifically have changed a lot, there's a lot more than one Chinese restaurant and two pizza places, that totally. Structure of the suburbs stays the same. And I thought you just captured that so well. And as someone who lives in the suburbs now, but kind of looks on it with a little bit of distaste, I always think, is there anything you miss about the suburbs, or is it truly based in this kind of nostalgia that we have?
Well, first of all, I should recommend Jason Diamond's Searching for John Hughes if you haven't read it yet, mm-hmm. which is also, he lived part of his life in Long Grove. Mm. And it's definitely like a, you know, it covers a lot of areas of his life, but he does talk about the suburbs in it as well. So you might like that if you want to read more about it.
Yeah.
You know, kind of reminiscing, but being, you know, with a gimlet eye as well. And he's a great writer. I couldn't wait to leave there when I lived there. I was like, how fast can I left? I started college when I was 17. I was like, how fast can I get out of here? But there was a moment in time, there was a pure moment in time when I was a child where, you know, when we're children, we're happy, mm-hmm. right? Until we're not, or, you know, maybe you stay happy forever, or maybe you're happy in high school, in which case the rest of the world will be a rude awakening for you. But there was, you know, you have these idyllic moments in your life. And like when I was growing up, like truly it was, that's the memory that I'm really, you know, capturing there is like, when it was just as simple as it could get. And when I moved to Buffalo Grove, it was, it was really just developing. Like my parents' house really was like the, you know, one of the first houses on the block, right? Like they were, and all the houses looked exactly the same. So I guess I'm reminiscing about a specific time when in my life, but, when you didn't question it, right? Yeah. You didn't, I don't know how old you are. I'm 50. So, but that would have been the 70s when I was like not questioning what it was. Mm-hmm. And a lot of America wasn't questioning what America was either.
Yeah.
And there's like a subtext to it. And the book is not about that, but I certainly do talk about how, you know, we were taught to believe one thing and, you know, that I know what kind of education I got. Mm-hmm. In the suburbs, you know, and it was definitely not something about honoring where we were from or, you know, question or like wondering who had the land before us or anything like that at all.
Yeah. And I'll specify, you know, you mentioned you're 50, I'm 26, but even growing up, it was taught very, very similarly. And I feel like only now, maybe in the last 5 or so years, are we really starting to question some of these structures that we've taken for granted.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, it's, and so like, I know that there, the land that was owned there, like where my house was, I know this isn't really about books, but was owned by a church. And that was like, as far as I knew, it was like cornfields everywhere. And, you know, and there was a lot of nature around and things like that. But surely somebody had the land before the church. So, and it was not something that we ever really like. You know, there's a library called Indian Trails.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. anyway, so there's just a lot there that's probably, you know, worth uncovering and worth thinking about. And I live in New Orleans now. And so it's much more, for better or for worse, much more keenly in touch with, you know, there's that city's like, you know, people come there to learn about the history.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
That's for sure. I mean, you write about New Orleans briefly, you write a lot about New York, which is a very similar city where, you know, people come there to learn about almost that myth of New York and how New York has come about and in a different way. It's a different history.
You
but
could just keep going for ever.
Yeah.
You know, you can like, you can sort of like travel, you can live your life and like, it's not really your job or obligation to understand every step, every second of your, you know, existence, like where, you know, what you're standing on, what land you're standing on. Right. Mm-hmm. But it's good to understand, have a general understanding at the very least, of history, the real history of this country.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And sort of speaking on travel and land in general, I think one of the major themes in this book is how much living you've done on the road, how many places you've been and how you've lived. And I have to ask the pandemic question. So, I mean, you're speaking now doing all of these in-person writing events, but for years, I mean, those were just not an option. Moving in the way you were likely used to moving was just not an option. Do you think your relationship to travel has changed irreparably? Do you think there is any going back to the way you thought about travel before?
I mean, this is the most travel that I've done, right? Like I flew to Florida last week because I did the Key West literary seminar, and then I flew to New York. Now I've taken a train to Philadelphia. I mean, it was very mapped out, like what I was willing to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll take a train tomorrow to DC, where I will not do an in-person event. So I've done 3 in-person events, and then my DC event got turned into a virtual event, and then everything else will be virtual except for maybe one thing in New Orleans. So I don't really love to fly I used to not mind to fly, and that then I, and I talk about this in the book, there's mm-hmm. a chapter about how I developed flight anxiety. And then I really had sort of worked through it. And now that it's, we're in the pandemic again, it's like all the bad behavior is sort of back. Although I, at least I recognize what it is, and I can kind of manage the anxiety more and have worked more on managing my anxiety more. I mean, I did a lot of groundwork, you know, I've done a lot of traveling and a lot of like building relationships over the years and meeting people and really wanting to meet people. And I do feel like I have a really great community out there, and I like to see people, and I do a lot of stuff online. And just last night when I did my event, I got to meet all these people who were participating in my 1,000 Words of Summer. They subscribed to my newsletter, Craft Talk. And that was really, it's really special to meet these people in real life. But it is hard to travel. It's just more, it's more difficult. It's like people are stressed out. I'm not even talking about, am I going to get a disease? I'm literally just like, the human interactions are more difficult because, you know, we can't, no one can smile at anybody else. Right. Mm-hmm. So you just sort of like at working overtime on like with your eyes and your voice, and you're in this crowded, you know, plane, like putting your bag, you know, everything. It's just like much more complicated to fly. So I do think that I probably will end up traveling less in my life or finding different ways to travel.
Yeah. I think that makes sense. I think a lot of people are kind of reevaluating things. And the longer the pandemic has gone on, the less we can think about its effects as temporary. I mean, in so many big, tangible ways, and also in these smaller ways, such as the decisions we make individually. But speaking of anxiety, I mean, who wants to start a sentence that way? But speaking of anxiety,
I do. Let's do it.
One of the things I personally had to do to manage my own anxiety, especially in the pandemic, was to severely limit Twitter. And you are someone who is active on Twitter. And I guess the question I have to ask you is, how can you stand it? Because for me, and I have like 10 Twitter followers, I follow maybe a couple hundred people. Like, I am a tiny ant in the world of Twitter, but I find myself so overwhelmed by just the constant barrage on Twitter. Do you have to place limits on yourself? Is that a kind of anxiety you're fine with?
So I'm sort of off and on it. I'm on it a lot right now because I have a book coming out, but basically I have it set up that I only see responses to my tweets from people I follow. Mm-hmm. So even though I have 30,000 followers or whatever it is, like, I'm not hearing from all of them.
Right.
And I mute people freely. I feel very happy to not like have to have information from every single person. I do have a person that I sometimes will just say, I don't want to be on Twitter today. It's, you know, it's just somebody who does this for a living, and I will just send her some tweets to post for me so that I don't have to look at it. If I'm like, I really have a lot of work to do, but I need to sort of put some information out there or something like that.
Right.
But it's always me. I'm always writing my own tweets, and I sort of don't really do that too much, because it's just, in a lot of ways, it's just easier for me to be me. Yep. But basically, like, it's what I like a year ago, like sat down more than a year ago, sat down and like really reassessed my relationship with it and what I want with, not just with Twitter, but with social media in general, and like what I wanted to accomplish. Mm-hmm. Like, I was like, you don't want social media to be using you. You want to be using it. Right. Mm-hmm. So you have to decide what you want to get out of it. Like, if you don't want to be on it, then don't be on it. Cause you don't need to be on it. Or maybe there's like another social, you know, maybe like Instagram's better for you. I'm not on Facebook. Like, I'll go on like literally like once in a month or something, and I'll just post a link to something. And if I'm on there, I'm just like, I gotta get off. That interface really kills me.
Yeah.
So I just can't, every time I get on there, I'm like, they've somehow managed to put more garbage to make, you know, on the interface to make it unusable. So I can't go anywhere near Facebook, but Twitter is like, it just, for whatever reason, it just works for me. So when I reassessed it, I was like, well, I want to be helpful on the internet. Mm-hmm. I want to entertain people. I want to talk about books. I want to be able to promote other people. Those are kinds of, you know, and like, I want to get like recommendations for restaurants or something, like, you know, like see what people are talking, what they're eating in New Orleans, that kind of thing. So like, those are the things that I like decided to focus on. And so when I'm not getting that, when those things aren't happening, then I'm not on there. I'm not like, you know, and then also like, because I had a book coming out, I was like, all right, well, I want to like be able to like promote the book in some ways, but I just really sat down and like wrestled with it and wrestled with myself and figured out how to use it. And the other thing was, I decided to like start a newsletter, and that's really where I can put my like, you know, permanent ideas. And I also delete my tweets once a week.
Okay.
All my tweets. Cause I don't think of it as my finest work. So they're all up right now. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh no, I was just saying, it sounds like you have a very well thought out and healthy relationship to Twitter, which is, I think, something we can all aspire to.
Well, I mean, because it's part of my job at this point, you know?
Right.
So if it's like, you know, it's not just like fun and games for me. So I have to have a positive relationship with my work.
Yeah, absolutely. You know?
Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's me, and I like have fun with it and want other people to have fun with it. And I don't want to be negative on there. I was just tweeting about it today that I was like, just sit down and really think about what you want to do with it. You know, like don't let it make you feel bad. There's no reason for that. I mean, if you feel like freaking out and being really stressed out, you'll find that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. The algorithms read your mind. I firmly believe it. It's true.
Yes.
They read your mind. They pick up on your stress, and you will feed into that. And I think that's a very valid point, but it makes sense. It's part of your job, and you got to find a healthy relationship to it.
If you dig long enough online, you'll find something that will make you feel bad. Either it's something somebody said about you, or it's like a piece of information that's, you know, puts fear in your heart. Or so I don't have blinders on. I read the paper every day, but I also like don't want to read this people freaking out about the same news story over and over again.
Right, right. You can read the story once, but the commentary is where it gets, it gets trying. But enough about Twitter. I want to take this moment to transition a little bit to the book you chose to discuss for this episode, which I was really intrigued by because you're the first person to suggest in a couple of years of doing this show, you're the first person to suggest a collection of short stories, which I was very excited for. And so the story collection you picked, it's the collected stories by Grace Paley. So her body of work, so to speak, in this genre. And so when you talk about a collection of short stories, I mean, this is not going to be our in-depth plot analysis. I mean, there's so much you can look to and there's so many stories here. So a lot of this is going to be talking about Grace Paley's writing itself. And I guess the best place to start is, Jamie, can you tell me a little bit about, do you remember first encountering Grace Paley's work and what drew you to it?
I started reading Grace Paley when I was in college, and it was just such a like vibrant voice. Like it was just, I just felt like she was completely like owning her entire universe, and it was really organic, and it just felt like you could hear it in your ear, and it was all kind of, you know, this like first person speaking to you directly, and it was very New York. I was in from the Midwest, but like I was like interested in the East Coast, and I went to school on the East Coast, and my parents were from the East Coast. So it was that sort of like struck something in me. And she had these, you know, has a lot of female characters who are just kind of trying to do the best they can do in this world. So I remember reading those stories and thinking, this is, and she wrote about domestic matters, right?
Yes.
So, and I say that in quotation marks. But, and I think that like, I had been like, had read a lot of fiction, certainly, in high school, but also in college that, was maybe a little dismissive of domestic matters, right? These personal intimate stories. And those were kinds of the things, but those were the things that I was interested in writing about. And so I saw that she'd done it, and she'd done it with great success. And that she was revered, and that there was something about her candor that was really appreciated in the world. And I thought that was like, it just sort of became like the North Star for me, right? To get to like sort of get to that place. And then weirdly, she was visiting, I never have met her, but she was a visiting teacher, maybe in the writing, there was a graduate writing program at my college. And I remember seeing her walk across the quad one day. And it would have been 92 or 93, something like that. So she wasn't really, I don't think teaching, you know, she wasn't writing anymore. I don't think she was like an activist then, but she was probably still teaching. And I just saw her and she was just kind of this vision, this gray hair and like cherubic smile. And I think she was like a shorter woman. And I, you know, I've been reading her and there she was like right in front of me. And I just remember that and just sort of being really starstruck watching her walk across the quad. So that's kind of the starting point for me. And then I, you know, usually keep a collection of her stories on my desk. And it's sometimes it's just like, oh, I've forget how to write. And then I can just open it up to a page of that book or, you know, dive into her, one of her stories. And I remember how to write again afterwards.
That's such a good way of putting it. Her work does really kind of remind you of how to write and also how you can write, because she does so many things differently from other writers. Just the way she puts stories together, the way she incorporates dialogue and characters talking. And that's actually the context I first encountered Grace Paley. So I had never heard of her until about 2 months ago when I took a writing class. And then on a part of the class, it was a class on dialogue. And we read the story, the first few pages of Once, one of her stories, which I've bookmarked here. And to refresh everyone's memory, if you've never heard of this story, it starts, I saw my ex-husband in the street. I was sitting on the steps of the new library. Hello, my life, I said. And then it goes on. He said, what life? No life of mine. And it goes on from there. And I thought that was such an interesting choice to pick for a class about dialogue, because it completely goes against the idea that dialogue has to be how real people talk, because none of Grace Paley's characters, especially in that story, none of their dialogue mimics real speech, nor does it need to. And I just find that, you know, really interesting and unique to read. You don't have to make this hyper-realistic distillation of real speech. It's more of a free and direct discourse, and nobody real talks like these characters. And that's like the first thing that stands out to me about her writing, is the way she just kind of ignores some of those formal conventions.
Yeah, she's great. She just wrote as she, I think, to the sound of her inner voice, you know.
Yeah. It's really just a matter of understanding your voice and just having that intuition almost as a writer. And it's just a lot of gift is what you can see in this writing. And then another,
that's a lesson, right? The lesson is like to listen to your, is really to listen to yourself, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That's what I took from it anyway.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense, to listen to your own voice and write in a way that feels authentic to you. And I'm sure there's been lots of writers who try to mimic Grace Paley, but Grace Paley strikes me as a kind of writer who didn't try to mimic anyone but herself. And there's so much to admire about that.
She was like, oh, I think I know what my, you know. So like, I think the takeaway from her is not to try to write. Yeah, don't try to write like her, but just like understand that like you're, what you have to say is important. You know, the stories that you have to tell are important, and it's about sort of tapping into that. You know, I think we can study lots of other writers and take away things from them. But ultimately, I think my favorite writers are the ones who are not just Grace Paley, but any writer who just really sort of gets themselves. Not even if, I'm not saying it's like has to be about you, autobiographical, but, you know, to write sort of fearlessly like that is really important.
Right. Definitely fearless and understanding what your strengths are and highlighting those. And another way she sort of goes against convention is she completely gets rid of that need for exposition in a lot of her stories. So, for instance, you'll see two characters interacting and she'll just throw you right in the middle of a scene. She's not going to set up for you how they know each other, what their history was. It's something you have to kind of figure out in a lot of your stories. So you have to figure out that Peter and Anna used to be lovers and now they have this child, but things are difficult. That's something you kind of have to put together. It's not spoon-fed for you, which is also very refreshing.
Yes, I agree.
And I'm wondering if you have any specific stories that you see as a particular standout, any specific story that comes to mind right away.
Oh, I mean, I always love Goodbye and Good Luck. Mm-hmm. That's really a sweet story. That's about you know, a woman telling her niece, Rosie telling her niece, Lily, about just kind of her falling in love and like falling in and out of love in her life. And then it's just really like the voice is really, this isn't really like the right word to use, but I always think of the voice as really crumbly for some reason. Like I could just like sort of, or gravelly, like I can sort of imagine that there's this gravelly voice because she's like older and kind of like been through her life a little bit. And she's just telling the story to her niece. And then there's just this really sweet ending to it. Well, I don't want to give away the ending in case anyone's going to go and read it, but there's a really sweet ending to it. And it might've been one of the first stories of hers that I read. And it was like, it was kind of this unabashed love story. And I don't know, it just really, it really touched me. You didn't know where it was going. And there was a propulsiveness to it also. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I just really admired that story a lot.
Yeah, that one stands out to me too. I mean, partially because in this collection, it's the very first story of the collection, the one that I have. And it's a lot more tender than some of the other stories. A lot of Grace Paley stories, she doesn't shy away from the kind of ugliness of city living, of these fraught relationships. There's a lot of ugliness in these stories, but this one's got a lot of tenderness to it. And then there's that retrospective, that story within a story nature of having it told to someone. And that does add that texture to the voice as well. And yeah, that one's definitely a standout for me. I really liked the stories. There's a few of them featuring the character Faith, who is this single mom. She has these two husbands and we see her a few times in the collection. And as we kind of grow to see her, we're seeing her sort of develop this sense of self as not just a mother and wife, but as a woman, as a person. Just how she navigates that and just shows a lot of the complexities with motherhood and domesticity. And again, without spoon feeding a lot of those cliches to you, there's this particular image that's coming to mind where she's sitting with a child sort of resting on her. And then the vision she gets is almost of stripes mimicking prison. And it's just this way of phrasing sort of the confines of motherhood without being overt about them, but creating an image that sticks with you. So I really liked the ones where she goes into Faith's character really deeply.
Yeah, Faith is like, you know, her double. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to see she's able to sort of write about what her concerns were at the time and what the concerns were of women like her at the time, you know? So it's sort of like gives you like a sense of history too.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. And when you read a whole collection like this, we're talking about a couple standout stories, but you know, when I picked this up, I thought it might have been like a selection from some of her stories, but it's in fact just all of the stories she wrote, like the three collections she wrote, just sort of put into one volume, at least my edition. And so with some of those, you're not going to get every story that sort of hits you hard. Some of them, the resolutions don't wrap up quite neatly, or you end the story wondering, wait, what just happened here? But the ones that do stick with you, maybe this is the kind of collection to sort of pick up as you go rather than reading it all in one session the way I did for the show. But
yeah,
definitely something to sort of pick and choose and feel your way through. I think there's a lot to learn just from her writing style.
She's great. And she only did, you know, the three books. So she's a classic. Mm-hmm. She's a classic. Pick her up.
Absolutely. And then she devoted the rest of her life to other pursuits, her activism, like you mentioned. I mean, she saw her window and made the most of it.
Yeah, she's a hero.
And so this is usually where I like to bring in other books that I'd recommend along the same vein. And so for me, I was thinking about, you know, short stories, women writing boldly, women writing with voice. And I guess the obvious comparison I made was A Manual for Cleaning Women by Lucia Berlin. Lucia Berlin's compared a lot to Grace Paley in some of her blurbs and her writing, but I really liked in Berlin's work. I read that about a few years ago. There's a melancholy to a lot of those stories, but there's still some humor there. There are some bold topics. I remember a few stories that take place in an abortion clinic, which even for her context was, even for now, would be considered bold. But for her context and when she was writing a lot of these, that was a statement in and of itself. And it sort of gets rid of a lot of the sentimentality you would expect from a place like that. So I think if you were looking for a companion to some of Grace Paley's work, Lucia Berlin's work might be a good place to go. But that's my view. Jamie, do you have any books that you'd recommend for someone who likes Grace Paley?
Oh, you know, I would think as a counterpoint to it, in a way, would be The Secret Lives of Church Ladies by Disha Filial.
Yes.
Because it's like, it's definitely like it's church ladies, right? So it's like, it's a different kind of like, you know, tussle with like a different kind of guilt, yes. You know, but it is about women and love and sex and food and family and family secrets and all the voices, you know, all the different voices. It's a lot of first person, very authentic, and it's, you know, you can just hear the ear again, you know, of Disha, right? Like you can just tell that she's just like writing like from her true inner voice while she's writing it. So I think that those are actually great companion. That's a great companion book for somebody who is, who likes Grace Paley.
Absolutely. I loved Disha Filial's book. I really loved the sense of voice she brought to those characters and the nuance she was able to give them. And religion plays a big role in a lot of Grace Paley's work. You know, it's an undercurrent to a lot of character motivations and coming to terms with faith. I mean, it's a different time and a different context and a different demographic, but a lot of those themes completely hold up. So I think that's a great choice.
We win. We won. We did it. We figured it out.
And I would say, you know, for everyone looking to dig into some short stories, or if you're just looking to study the short story craft, I mean, if you're going to read Hemingway, pick up some Grace Paley. I mean, you want to see kind of the spectrum of what stories can do. So with your Raymond Carver and your Hemingway, you need to have Grace Paley there with you. She's a classic for a reason. So definitely do recommend her work. And of course, highly recommend Jamie's memoir. I don't know. I thought the two together, reading them so close together, they kind of played off of each other very interestingly. I mean, it's these two women who are writing about their lives and different facets of their lives. Obviously, one's fiction and one isn't, but I thought the two went together quite well.
I mean, I'll take it. I'll take it. Buy everybody's books, guys.
All right. And speaking of that, Jamie, you know, where can we find you and where can we find your work?
Well, I have an event. I have lots of events coming up, virtual events, I think. But I have one that's a Chicago virtual event, Women and Children. Monday? Oh my gosh. You're going to find out and you're going to say it later.
I'll put a link to it in the show
notes. But I'm doing it with the great poet, Ada Limón, who I am a huge fan of, and she's my friend, and we're going to be in conversation. I think it's on Monday. I'm really looking forward to it because, you know, she has a wonderful book that's coming out soon. And, both of us were writing our books during the pandemic. So it'll be really interesting. And we both read each other's books already. So it'll be interesting to talk to each other about it. But I have also some events coming up. I'm going to do an event with Patricia Lockwood through Skylight. Benjamin Dreyer on Friday. This Friday. Mm-hmm. I'm not including any of the dates. It's really bad. Today's the 13th. The 15th is when I'll do one with Ben.
Today's the 12th.
Oh, God. God bless you for now.
It's fine. Who knows what days are?
14th. The 14th is this Friday. So there'll be, you know, if you happen to hear this week. But, and then I have one with Isaac Fitzgerald. And that's it. And then if you're in New Orleans, hopefully one of these in-person events will still be happening. You can buy my book anywhere. You could buy it at any bookstore, because even if they don't have it at your local independent bookstore, they will order it for you because they are cool like that. Or you could order it from somewhere else on the internet, if you want to. And, I have a bunch of other novels too you could read, but this is the one This is the one we care about right now.
Of course, we care about the backlist too, but definitely we'll have links to buy the book in our show notes, and we'll have links to some of Jamie's events as well. Definitely going to check out that one with women and children. I love all the events they run, and such a great store. Yeah. One that I desperately miss living out in the suburbs and not getting.
Why are you in the suburbs? You're so young. You should be out in the city.
I work in Indiana.
Oh. Mm.
So this is a middle ground.
Gotcha. Well, maybe someday you'll be back in the city.
I do love the city. I do love Chicago. Yeah. And anyway, Jamie, thank you so much for your time. I greatly appreciate it. And I wish you some rest in this busy week.
Thank you so much. It was nice to talk to you. Take care.
And of course, thank you all for listening to this episode. If you like the show, please let me know. There are all sorts of ways you can place reviews now. Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen to podcasts, there's usually a review function. I'd really appreciate your feedback. And of course, you can follow the show on Instagram and Twitter at YFB Podcast. And definitely read The Waltz by Dorothy Parker coming up for our episode on January 26th. Y'all, it's a super short story, and I'd really love to have as many readers as possible for this inaugural episode of the Short Story Club. And of course, if you've got a name for it, let me know, because I'm kind of bad at that thing. All right, take care. Happy reading.